The thing about coos deer that I found is that when I get to 60 yards, I don't try to get any closer, because at 60, 70, 80 yards, I don't see the reaction that you see, because they don't hear the bow. So you're far enough away from the bow that they don't turn inside out like they do when you're under those.
Once I was hunting enough, I witnessed it enough times that, you know, these animals, they communicate, they're a herd animal. So as long as I can figure out how to communicate with them, there's no reason why this wouldn't work. So I threw out all that traditional knowledge that grandpa and your dad had told you and told you not to do. I threw all that out, basically started from scratch, and my success rate just started, you know, increasing drastically year over year. And I've also learned that today he may run away from me. Tomorrow he may run right to me. And that's why I consistently try to be aggressive and challenge them. It's not 100%, but when it does work, it works exactly how it's designed to work. So it doesn't matter how bad you are at elk calling. They still think you're an elk, as long as you're speaking the language.
Right.
Which took a whole lot of stress and pressure early on off of me for wanting to be perfect at my calls. The biggest mistake I see from the majority of the people, and including myself early on, is I wanted to call the animal into whatever I was in. You know, if that means if I was in the timber, I wanted to call him out of the meadow into the timber. But I learned that if I get into their environment, then I am likely going to be successful.
Welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. A couple things before we jump into this episode. Please, you heard me say a million times, go give us a review on iTunes. Helps me keep this podcast free and helps with the ratings. Also, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. If you use our promo code John Stallone, all one word, you save 20% off on anything. And it's not just shooting bags. They do glassing pads. They're working on some other really cool stuff coming up here for the hunter, bow hunters also. So go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. And if you're looking for a really good hunt, I have some really good opportunities for you. Hit us up on daysinthewild.com or check out my blog, johnstallone.me, and send us an email. If you're looking to do a coos deer hunt, javelina, mule deer in South Dakota, we got some opportunities in California as well. So give me a call if you're looking to do something different this year and like to get on a special hunt. Days in the Wild Outfitters, and we'll take care of you. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode. Shannon, real quick, give us a little quick rundown about yourself, and then we'll hit it.
Yeah, Shannon Mobbs. Grew up here in the Pacific Northwest. I primarily hunt Roosevelt elk. I've been doing it for probably close to 30 years now. I've killed multiple in the coastal rainforest jungle. John's been out here a few times. He knows what this place is like.
Yep.
A lot of obstacles.
Cambodia.
Yeah, it's... It's a unique place when we're talking archery. You know, here to shoot 30 yards is a long shot. So, as we were talking about with arrow setup, is you know, penetration and trying to get something that's, you know, the most lethal setup you can possibly put on your bow is what we try to achieve.
Something that gives you the forgiveness, the best of all worlds. You know, that's all you can hope for.
Yeah,
that's all you can hope for. I think, especially if you're a hunter that hunts multiple species in multiple states with multiple different types of terrain, you know, it's like you gotta be able to be flexible. You can, you know, I guess if you're shooting out of a tree stand all the time, or you know, ground blind or whatever, and it's a very controlled environment, you could be very specific about your setup, you know, because you know what you're going to face, because it's the same thing pretty much over and over, you know, where especially spot and stalk and going to multiple states, that changes constantly. Every time you take a step, it changes. So,
yeah, for sure. You almost want to just have setups, you know, if you can afford it, a bow set up for smaller game, you know, deer sized game. They're a lot faster. You know, coos deer specifically have such a fast reflex that you're shooting them at 50 yards and you're not pumping something out at 300 plus feet a second. You're probably not hitting it.
Right.
It's reacting faster than your arrows.
I've done that before because, you know, luckily for me, I don't have to afford it. I usually have two or three bows just because of my relationships with Matthews and the companies that I work with. But I've done that. Here's the shitty part about that is your confidence goes way the frick down. Like, you know how it is when you're shooting with the same bow all season long and then you go on a hunt. Like, it's part of you. And you could do whatever you want to set that bow up exactly the same. I use the same sights, the same rest, the same everything on every bow. So that doesn't change from year to year. Use the same release, you know, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, you could just change the tune and the arrow on each of the bows but it's still not the same. Like you get comfortable with a certain amount of arc, with a certain amount of this, with a certain amount of everything. And it's just not the same. I remember not too long ago, I think it was the year that I came, that I shot that bull with when I was hunting with Corey, I had three bow setups that year. Mm-hmm. I had that bow, which I had specifically for elk hunting. Then I had my deer bow, my deer and all other game bow. And then I was also shooting my trad bow because I was going to hunt in New York. So I was going back and forth between three bows and trying to be well practiced and proficient between the three. Man, I never felt so like I had a lot of anxiety going into every hunt because I wasn't comfortable and feeling super confident with the equipment that I was going with because I was like, oh, last week I was practicing with this one and you try to practice leading up to the hunt that you're going to with the bow that you're going to use, obviously, but every once in a while you have to throw in the other one. So it was just a weird feeling and weird year. And I think that's, some people might be able to get over that. But that for me was tough to have multiple setups. So I go back to what I look at the years that I had lots and lots of success, and I went on like a 15-year run where I had 85% of my tags that I got, I filled. And I look at those years and I'm like, man, I was running the same bow. Like I would get new bows from Matthews, just shoot them at 3D and whatever to fulfill my contractual deals. And then I was hunting with my same bow because of confidence level. And it came down to like being confident and having a setup that you knew performed.
Yeah. And all the little information that you hold, you know, you retain subconsciously.
Right.
It's hard to have all that for three setups.
Exactly.
You know, that arc and how the bow handles and how it aims in certain conditions. I was in Hawaii last, 2020 in February. And I don't know if you've ever hunted the Axis deer.
I have, but not in Hawaii.
But those things are like coos deer on speed.
Yep.
And
super, super fidgety.
The very first buck I shot at, was typical. I'm shooting my elk setup for the most part because I hadn't really experienced, other than the coos, haven't really experienced anything that had the ability to completely out jump the speed of my bow. You know, at a reasonable distance out to, 50 or 60 yards. That first coos I shot at, he was gone before my arrow even got close. and you know, earlier on I was told by some locals that, hey, you have to aim, you can't aim at these animals. You have to aim below them. And I could not.
No.
There's no way, I just thought, no way. I just aim like I do, aim right at them, hit them right where I'm aiming.
Yeah.
Well, I ended up finally, when I killed one, I had aim below it. And as it loaded its legs to spring off, that's when the arrow impacted. So, you know, my arrows were going over the top of them because they would drop down to jump, mm-hmm. and then my arrow would go past, and they were just too fast. So what you need to do for that setup is to have something extremely fast.
Yeah.
You know, or fast. Around.
Have a quieter bow. Hey, one other thing we were, this is the other quick thing we brought up when I was talking with Randy Ulmer about this. We had that old podcast on string jump. And the thing about coos deer that I found is that when I get to 60 yards, I don't try to get any closer because at 60, 70, 80 yards, I don't see the reaction that you see because they don't hear the bows. You're far enough away from the bow that they don't turn inside out like they do when you're under those. And when I'm under, like, you know, if I was shooting off a water hole or whatever, I don't shoot when they're perfectly still. When they're taking like a step or whatever, that's when I shoot, because when they're already subconsciously doing something, their reaction time's that much slower. Yeah. And that's what I found works for me. And, you know,
luckily. Yeah, that's years of experience.
Luckily, it's working out for me, but exactly. But how many times you got to miss to figure that out, right?
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but
it's fun learning all that stuff, though.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's why most of us are out there, is to the experiences, sure. You know, the adventure of it all. I definitely picked up a couple of things over the years coming to hunt with you guys that I wanted to, you know, I want to come back and have another crack at it. I just haven't been able to fit it in my schedule. And I think now in my head, I feel like I'm equipped with the right tools to make it happen. Especially having been so close already a few times now. But
yeah. And just, you know, you're familiar with the obstacles that this environment presents to you. They're no longer a shock to you, so you can,
right.
You know, deal with them.
Exactly. Anthony's going to come out and hunt with you this year?
Well, we were talking yesterday. I'm looking at the dates. I'm going to see his availability because I think his elk hunt down there kind of fell through.
Yep.
Yeah, he's more than welcome to come out.
Yeah, we were supposed to help my cousin Joe out. But I think he's going to end up turning his tag because of work.
It's shitty because
he hasn't had an elk tag in 6 years. So,
wow.
But he just got a new job and he's afraid of
it. He must love his job.
Yeah. Well, it's brand new job. So I think he's worried that, you know, to ask for 2 weeks off that quick,
he should have done it before he got hired. So that's a condition of me being hired.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they need him more than he needs them. He needs to understand that.
Yeah. Seriously. Today's day and age.
Yeah. No kidding.
It's bad out there. It is bad out there. So, yeah. Originally, I had you on. We obviously went down a rabbit hole over here, but I had you on so you can share with us some lessons learned, some good stories where you know, stuff happened, like, you know, kind of what we were just talking about, but which changed the way you hunt, or if we want to talk about elk specifically, things that made you realize how you hunt them now.
Yeah, man. One of them was my setups and just figuring out what's you're most comfortable with and what ends up leading to success for you. So I think we pretty much dialed that in.
Yeah. Is that
the, I'm going to speak. I'm going to speak.
Patrick, was that Patrick that you skewered the tree limb on?
Yep. Yeah. I skewered the tree with Patrick with a bull called Mango. I didn't recognize my sight window, and I shot a larger arc than I could see, and totally shanked that shot too. And that was another 15 yard. Steering wheel was the one that I was saying that was a 3 yard little twig. And then it was really not an obstacle. It was just a maybe a quarter inch thick little dry twig off of a fir tree. Mm. It deflected that arrow far enough at 18 yards. That particular bull was 18 yards. It's on the YouTube channel.
Yeah, I've watched that one. I remember.
Yeah. It led to, you know, not being successful. A stud Roosevelt that we work all season to get in on. No, it's, we work all year, mm-hmm. you know. And then for it to all to not execute right at that last second is
heartbreaking,
very disappointing. It's heartbreaking. I wear it all year. I don't know if anybody else does, but if I make a mistake, and that's my mistake. Nobody else's. It's not just oops happens when you go hunting. That's just a mental breakdown, really, not recognizing your obstacles. I wear that all year long, so same I do here. Everything I can. Yeah, I do everything I can to prevent those things. And getting that perfect setup is the thing. I can control that, so I'm 100% responsible for the outcome of that setup.
Exactly.
Patrick, Patrick, when I shot and I hit the tree, that was a risky shot. I knew it was risky. Very similar situation when it was my sight window. I wasn't, I just didn't see a large enough picture to see my obstacles. I was too narrowly focused, like we said. Yeah, I was looking at that laser beam. Didn't see the twig hanging down a little bit, boom, which that made it go high. And pinwheeled that tree, though. I spent like an hour getting that broadhead out of there.
Oh, yeah, they penetrate well.
They do.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I think I also learned early on that, when I started Roosevelt hunting with a bow, early 90s, you know, all the old timers would tell you, can't call to them, you can't do this, you can't do that, it doesn't work. And I think that really kind of set me back in my success, mm-hmm. Believing a lot of that old traditional knowledge of, you know, elk, you know, you can't bugle bulls in and all this and that. Once I was hunting enough, I witnessed it enough times that, you know, these animals, they communicate, they're a herd animal. So as long as I can figure out how to communicate with them, there's no reason why this wouldn't work. So I threw out all that traditional knowledge that grandpa and your dad had told you and told you not to do. I threw all that out, basically started from scratch. And my success rate just started, you know, increasing drastically year over year. So, yeah, I'd say a good tip is to, you have to think outside of the box a lot of times and ignore that information you're getting from the masses that are only successful every, you know, 10 or so years, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Just by bugling. I don't even cow call. You've hung with me multiple times. And yeah, there's a lot of reason for that. Number one, I'm not targeting cows or young bulls. I'm targeting more mature roses. So that narrows down what I'm actually hunting for. Plus, cows are very territorial, and I start making cow sounds. That language is a little bit more complex than a screaming bull. I look at bull language as very primitive. It's like screaming and yelling at each other versus a detailed conversation, which cow talk can give you. Right. And there's probably more elk killed with cow talk, you know, cow calling than bugling every year. I understand that. But for the animal I'm specifically targeting, it's more of a risk for me to cow talk than it is for me just to bugle. Mm-hmm. You know, I can bugle at a herd, and the only one that looks at me is the bull. And I throw one cow call, and every cow, calf, spike, raghorn, mature mm-hmm. bull are all looking right at me. So I wade through that herd and get to that one animal that I'm targeting. So, you know.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
it makes sense. Your disguise is easier to mimic as a bull that time of year than it is if you're trying to be a cow, you know.
Yeah, and there's times where the only way you can kill the elk is with a cow call, but I have to prove that my bugling won't work first, and I usually never get to that point. I do have one video on the channel there that shows a particular case where the bugling wasn't working. Now, that's how I got him to answer. Mm-hmm. That's how I knew the bull was there. But every time I'd get close to him, he'd shut up. So I went back And fourth, it was about 300 yards I had to walk, and it was a ravine is what it was. When I was across the ravine, he would answer me. But once I got over on his side, he had shut up. So what I did the very last time, the third time, is I located him again. He was in the exact same spot. Then when I got close, I just cow called. What ended up being, it was a younger bull. He had a calf with him. And when I cow called, I cow called that calf in, and that bull followed.
Makes sense.
You know, huge lesson learned there.
Yeah. And that is identifying the situation. Like,
yeah,
exactly. What are you hearing? What is the bull telling you? I'm a bull by myself. I'm a bull that has cows. I'm a bull that's, you know, aggressive and wants to fight. I've talked about this many times on the podcast with other guests and stuff, but that's the hardest part, is reading the situation. Otherwise you're just throwing shit out there and hoping it sticks, right? You know?
Yeah. So, if, you know, paying attention to those little details, can lead to more and more success. And anymore, I can recognize when I get an answer from a non-dominant bull. Because I can't say a small bull, because a lot of times a younger bull can still be the dominant animal in that area.
Right.
And have the cows and have the breeding rights, if you will. And he'll act aggressive and defensive in his territory. But in places where there's more elk, there's bigger bulls, usually I can identify by the way it's not even the way he sounds as much as it is the emotion in his voice. If this bull is mature enough or is in the right mood or whatnot to be able to actually work and call in. It's not something I can even teach people, because I don't know if it's identifiable outside of just what it makes me feel like when I hear it. So it's so hard to put even into words, let alone, you know, present it to a crowd. And it's experience is probably the only thing that gets you to be able to recognize when you're likely on a bull that's going to just come charging in or not.
Yeah, reading emotions is a tough thing to do, and then it's an even tougher thing to explain.
Yeah.
You know, I recognized this in you when Anthony was with me the last time I was there, and I had located that bull, and I don't know if I ran into you or ran back and got you, and then we dropped in after that bull, and you told me immediately, like, this is a young bull that is shy. He's answering because he wants to be with the herd, but he's not. And sure as shit, that was what I mean. We almost got him. We were
almost,
you know, if we
were, almost got lucky on him.
If we were in clearer, you know, understory, that was a dead bull, because we were in range, just too thick.
Yeah, I think we had him at 60.
Yeah, yeah.
And at 55, he would have been dead.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. But yeah, so right away, you could just tell by the way he was. You know, his emotion and his voice that
it seemed timid.
He's going to let us get close to him, relatively close, but probably not close enough to kill him. And I played this game you can do this for days on end with these younger bulls. So being able to turn around and just go find another elk is important for just being successful year in and year out.
Yeah. And I realized that with that one bull that you call Patrick. Then when Anthony and I had a crack at him, you and I were on him the night before, and it just got dark on us before we could get close enough. And I just knew he was going to be somewhere in that ridge. And then I went back there the next morning with Ant, and I relocated him, did almost everything right. And then I knew once we got in close, based on experience, because I had interactions with him last year the year prior with, I think it was either you or Corey, I don't remember, but where every time we get in close and we start challenging him, he would round up his cows and go. And for whatever freaking reason, that didn't stick in my head. And I did the same thing. I'm like, all right, man, I could see the tips of his freaking horns in the jack pines, you know? And I was like, he's close enough. I'm gonna let him have it right now. And I let him have it. And as soon as I did that, he started freaking around the bugling and taking the cows away. And I'm like, oh, son of a bitch. I probably could have did anything different than that, than challenge him. And it probably would have went my way. You know, cow called, shut the fuck up and didn't do anything.
Maybe he would, tree.
Yeah, whatever. Glunked. Yeah, something.
Who knows?
Yeah. But,
it could have likely been the same, result for anything you did too. So
yeah, that bull's been hunted by you a lot.
Yeah. And I've also learned that today he may run away from me. Tomorrow he may run right to me. So
yeah.
And that's why I consistently try to be aggressive and challenge them. It's not 100%, but when it does work,
it works the right way.
It works exactly how it's designed to work. And to kill these elk in this country, you have to get them to come to you at least 20, 30 yards, just enough to give you that shot opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And really, when I'm calling elk, that's all I expect. I don't ever expect, I'm 400 yards away. I don't expect that elk to come even 100 yards my direction. It happens sometimes.
Yeah.
But I don't expect it. What I expect to happen is for him to let me get closer and then him come 20 or 30 yards to present a shot to me.
Yeah. That terrain lends itself to that for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I early on in my calling, learning, I guess you could call it, I found a bull. I ended up naming him Yo-Yo. And from this experience and the multiple experiences with this bull is what would happen is he was in this basin almost every single day. And I'd go there, I'd call him in within shooting distance, and he just, he's not big enough. Let him walk off. I'd go look for other elk, and I'd come back a day or two later, and he's in the same spot. Okay, today I'm going to kill him. So I go down in there and I call him right back in. Okay. And every time I'm calling him in, he's spooking.
Really?
So, yeah.
So he's catching your wind. They're seeing you.
He's catching our wind. He's seeing us. Or I stood up, once to get him to run off. I did this three different times in a season. We never ended up shooting the bull because every time he come in, he was like, man, I really don't want to kill him. Because he was a little 4-point. He wasn't big, but he did have a harem. And in that particular canyon in that country, he was the stud bull, or at least he thought he was. But what I learned there is this elk came to me three different times, spooked him every single time, and he never figured out that I was a human. And from that experience, I've learned that, elk will never understand that a man can talk elk. So it doesn't matter how bad you are at elk calling. They still think you're an elk.
As long as you're speaking the language.
As long as you're speaking the language.
Right.
Which took a whole lot of stress and pressure early on off of me for wanting to be perfect at my calls. And that's built off of other people telling you what perfect is.
Right.
So then I could actually focus on the hunt itself and my approach to the animal, how fast I got on them, other than just the sounds I was making. So little details like that. If you retain something such as this elk will never understand, and you believe it, that they'll never understand that I'm a human and a human can talk elk, then I don't have to worry about not sounding good. I can focus on other aspects of the hunt.
That's it's reassuring to me. So I had another guest on, and I'm sure people will figure it out when I tell the story, but basically told me there's no way I was going to get that bull because I already had called to him two or three days in a row and he knew it was me. And part of me wants to believe him, but I didn't tell him the whole story because I didn't want to share with everybody on the podcast what I did as far as calling wise and what I was using calling wise, that one, that it was kind of impossible that he would know it was the same person, but just because I was using different reeds and different sounds and whatever. But anyway, I just now hearing you say that, kind of like solidifies in my head what I thought as well. Like I tend to agree with you that yes, elk can get educated, and there's certain things that you can do that they're going to be like, okay, that's not an elk. But if you're speaking the language and you're saying the right things at the right time, even though you're not saying it with the right accent, or, you know, you don't have the greatest voice or whatever, yeah, they're not going to know that it's a human.
Yeah, I think it's there's a little bit more to it. As they can get callous to, let's say you're bugling from one spot every single day. Mm-hmm. The first time you go there, you got four answers. But the 10th time you've gone there, you're not getting any answers. Mm-hmm. I think what happens is an elk, here's another elk from a certain location, or even a certain sound, or, you know, because they recognize voices. So they will, if they hear you enough, recognize your voice. And they'll associate that voice with, is that a threat? Does it belong here? Is it not a threat? And I think when an elk's heard you enough, and there's nothing to associate with what they hear to a bad experience, they just become callous to it. It doesn't have the same reaction. So if the first day that I'm in a new area is usually the most productive, I'm a new elk in their area. They haven't heard my voice this year. They don't have any negative experiences with it. I'm not just some background noise that I may become if I keep pounding the countryside day in and day out without ending in success. Mm-hmm. So they'll never understand it's a human. Even if they hear a car door shut, they hear a rig drive, you stop, you get out, you bugle. They're probably a little scared because of what they just heard. But as far as the elk bugling, they'll never associate that elk with that human. They may not go running over towards where they heard the rig driving because they've had bad experiences with that. But they still won't put together that the human was making that elk sound. So that lesson over the years and years is, you know, it took a lot of stress and pressure off me. And like I said before, you know, it allows me to focus on other aspects of the hunt, which are far more important, you know, the weather, which was a huge deal with elk. How comfortable they are is directly related to how aggressive they are. So,
weather.
Focus on little things. Yeah, weather's huge.
Fucking every time I go to freaking Oregon, I'm soaking wet and in super windy conditions the whole time I'm there.
Yeah, so I can associate bad weather with John Stallone.
Exactly.
And that's from experience.
Me and my black cloud follows me around. I don't know
what the deal there is.
Jesus. Ugh. Anyway, yeah, so if you got another quick story to share with us, and then I'll let you get back to work.
Yeah, so calling through transition areas, bad deal, low success rate. It happens, it works. You call them out into a meadow, you call them into a clear cut, you call them into an opening. But the biggest mistake I see from the majority of the people, and including myself early on, is I wanted to call the animal into whatever I was in. Now, if that means if I was in the timber, I wanted to call him out of the meadow into the timber. But I learned that if I get into their environment, then I am likely going to be successful. If whenever they have to change from a clearing to cover, from cover to a clearing, from the timber into a road, or whatever it may be, into a trail or something, my success rate was dropping out the bottom. So getting into their environment helped a ton. A good example of this was, you know, we mountain bike a lot in this country. Mm-hmm. Private timber companies have locked down most of the country for driving, so you have to mountain bike in. But so these elk travel are these roads as trails. And I call a bull from this below the road up to the road, and I could see his nose sticking out. And he looked left, he looked right, and then he backed up. So if I would have got into his environment, I probably would have killed that bull on that particular day. So if I just had a little bit of advice to give people, dogs freaking out.
No worries.
Get into their environment. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And that, I'm assuming that kind of leads to why you start hunting the time of day you want to hunt, right?
Somewhat, yeah, because they're locked down. They're not traveling. They're not moving. They hopefully cows are all bedded down. And the reason why I like to hunt midday for the most part is it's less fatiguing. When I find elk, they're not moving.
Mm-hmm.
And when those cows are down chewing their cud, this bull's less likely to try to get them to move. And he's going to have very little choice but then to come to me and defend his harem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's worked. It's just been extremely consistent over the years. It's, like I said before, it's way less fatiguing. I don't have to chase elk for miles. You know, it's not chasing it. You know, just keeping up with them. And what I learned is by starting at daylight, which is when you get most of your answers, the bulls were going somewhere. So then I would get behind them and I'd keep calling them, they're moving away. Early on, I interpreted that as them moving away from me. But in fact, what was happening is they're going somewhere already.
Right.
So as soon as they got there, boom, eternity come back in and I kill him. So then I just took out that early part of the day and I focused at, you know, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the afternoon where they're going to be for the majority of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get an answer. I go to them and then it's just super quick and easy.
Right. You make it sound so simple. Oh man. Well, cool. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing the knowledge with us. I'm kind of bummed that I'm not going to get out there this year, but
I'll do it next year.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm pretty convinced, at least according to Go Hunt, that next year I should draw the tag that I want in Wyoming. So I probably come out early to Oregon and then Wyoming late. That was my plan this year, was to do two elk hunts. But I had a client that was like, yeah, put in with me, da 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 da. And then decided to back out like 2 weeks ago. And I'm like, well, fuck, now I don't have nothing that time of year. And I'm like, I'm going to Idaho for elk late in September and part of the hunt. So my whole beginning part of September is open. I was thinking about putting something together, but it's kind of tough because I don't know. I got some clients for early coos deer here, which I'm not even sure we might actually move them to the late season because I'm not really happy with the fire situation and everything that's going on over here. So,
well, it's a problem everywhere. So, and that's, you know, you can never predict that. And that's a shitty thing about coming out here in this country early in September is we may have a fire problem. Late, we may have too much rain and wind, which is just as bad. So
yeah, that's what I've been accustomed to every time I've gone. I don't think had one day where it was dry the whole day. You know, at least not a little sprinkle.
And that makes it tough, man. This last year was very similar. We had super hot and dry. We got all that smoke, shut a bunch of shit down that had never been shut down in my entire lifetime.
Hmm.
Nowhere to hunt elk.
Yeah.
And then when that all cleared up, you know, it's pouring down rain. Finally, I got like a 3-day stretch of decent weather and we pounded out two bulls in those 3 days.
Nice.
And that was luckily, it was towards the tail end of the season, which is usually the most productive for me. We just got lucky and had a few nice days. Something that you haven't had the luxury of experiencing yet.
Nope.
And if you do get lucky and you're here during that time, it's an amazing experience. And I hope one day you guys get the opportunity. Hopefully Anthony gets that this year. We'll see.
I think Anthony will. He's putting his dues. He needs to get one. But not he hasn't put in his dues there in Oregon, but he's definitely putting his, I mean, he is yet. Now, Anthony has shot, I don't want to put him on blast here, but he's shot a few elk now. And this last one that he got this past year was same situation. Yeah. You know, it's like, yeah, he recovered it, but not, it wasn't a traditional, you know, happy situation. So anyway, but
yeah, it was quite the story.
Yeah. So hopefully he'll have a little smoother go at it. We'll see. But
well, he'll have fun with us if nothing else.
Yeah. Well, that's always a good time.
We'll drink Modelo's and orange juice or whatever.
Yeah. Anthony. Anthony juice. Got it. Yeah. All right, buddy. Well, thanks for coming on, and I will talk to you soon, I'm sure.
All right, John. Appreciate the invite, man. Love talking elk hunting. Same or any hunting for that matter.
Same, same. All right. Well, you guys coming out for deer this year or no?
We'll see. You know, I have this new baby.
Oh yeah, I heard about that. Congrats.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah. It's she's an amazing little creature. It's fun. But yeah, so I got an Oklahoma hut planned because I got that property down
right,
there.
Right, right, right. Nice.
And then I'm going to shoot for January archery hunt, but down there. We'll see where it gets us.
All right. Well, let me know. I'll talk to you later.
All right, bud. Okay. All right, man.
Bye.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out daysinthewild.com and be sure to give us a review on iTunes. Thank you. And we'll check you out on the next episode.